I'll Drink to That, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today.
Are you guys ready to get warmed up? Because I am.
One of the most tactile and relevant places that we can look for clues to the past is the graves of our ancestors. It's a bit unsavory, but buried with people who once lived thousands of years ago lie the secrets of their lives and cultures. For our purposes, there is a lot of ancient wine history that comes to us through tomb excavation. And those brave enough to search for these secrets have been able to shine a light on how wine influenced trade, politics, and even the quotidian existence of the everyday person. It's a pretty interesting thing. Some of the earliest pharaohs of Egypt were buried in ships, and sometimes fleets of ships. We're going back pretty far here, to about 5,000 years ago. In Abydos, there are several ships in a funeral grouping, sailing off to the sun god. On the ships, you can find everything the leader may have wanted for in the afterlife. And I mean everything. If you had been his sommelier, you would have been sacrificed too, to accompany the guy and make sure that no sediment ever touched his lips in heaven. What? Yep, all the attendants were sacrificed as well. Imagine signing a contract like that today. What kind of wine was in these early pharaohs' graves? Jar upon jar of resinated wine that had been shipped in from abroad. Some of the jars were flavored with herbs and spices and fruits. Later leaders in Egypt would establish their own supply, and they would found their own domestic wine trade. What's neat about these jars is that not only can we determine what was in them by analyzing their residues, but we can determine where they came from by analyzing the clay used in the pots. Much as oak from different places is sought out today for different flavors, I'm sure drinkers in the ancient world could distinguish between different clay and resin influences. Think of how Terra Rosa soil impacts the flavor of wine grown in it, and then think of how an amphora made from Terra Rosa would influence the flavor of the beverage inside. So the first dynasty pharaohs were drinking resin wine imported from abroad. But later dynasties had their own supply of Egyptian wine. Pharaoh Pepi, for instance, had five different kinds of clearly labeled wine in his tomb. He also had about five queens, too. Five kinds of wine, five queens. Coincidence? I'm not so sure. Maybe they each liked a different kind of wine. Fast forward 1,000 years, and wine is still popular. In fact, King Tut's tomb had several amphoras of red and white wine. And here, he wouldn't even be old enough to drink. But it wasn't just Egyptian pharaohs who were using wine in graves. A little farther north in modern-day France, vessels from closer to the Mediterranean have found their way into tombs there. The Vix crater is a famous bronze vessel found in a tomb of a young lady. It dates to around 2,500 years ago, and it's over 5 feet tall. It's one of the largest craters in the known world. And sometimes wine wasn't used just for drinking. All too often, we forget wine's antiseptic power in previous centuries. Being unable to trust drinking water, many people got much of their daily water intake through alcoholic beverages. Fermentation is one of the earliest water treatments. And so it's natural that we'd find wine, or other local alcoholic beverages, almost everywhere in ancient ruins. But sometimes wine was used as more than a conduit of safe drinking water. Come with me for a moment to the tomb of King Philip, the father of Alexander the Great. Now sure, he had plenty of wine drinking cups buried along with him, but wine had multiple purposes. When Alexander buried his father, he first set him ablaze in a giant funeral pyre. His charred bones were collected, and before they were placed in a gold box for all of eternity, they were washed in wine. What kind of wine was it? Red, white, orange? We don't know yet. Some secrets remain to be unearthed.
Oh yes, it's Levy, and I've got some exciting, exciting news for you. 750 is now available in several more states. That's right. The amazingly powerful and easy to use 750 service and search tools are now available for wholesale buyers to use in Illinois, Massachusetts, Washington, D.C., Virginia, Maryland, North Carolina, and South Carolina. That's in addition to all the states it's already been successful in: New York, New Jersey, California, Colorado, Connecticut, and Delaware. The 750 service is an amazingly powerful, simple to use, fundamental part of making your life as a wholesale buyer easier every day. Check it out, 750.com, for more information. That's 750.com. If you're a wholesale buyer in Boston, Chicago, D.C., anywhere in Virginia, check it out. 750 is there for you, ready to use. It's exciting. Get on it. Laurence Ferro of Domaine de Pagot and also Chateau Pagot on the show today. Am I saying that correctly?
Yes, you have to pronounce Pagot.
Pagot.
If you want to speak in Provençal.
Good thing I asked you.
And if you want to speak in French, you say Pagot.
Oh, is that true?
Yeah, Pagot in French, Pagot in Provençal.
I wonder why, that's probably why it's always been confusing to me. So which way do you prefer?
The way you feel more comfortable.
Okay.
So Pagot is in fact spelled with a tréma. In English, I don't know if you say it, umlaut.
An umlaut, sure.
An umlaut. So with the umlaut.
A funny house.
Yes, with the umlaut is in fact the Provençal spell, and the umlaut up to the U, that we pronounce OU.
Oh, okay.
And because French people and Parisians, especially Parisians, they dissociated the letter as German people. When we put the umlaut in German, they said PGAU and not Pagot. So I decided to take off the umlaut. Then the people, they pronounce the way in Provençal as a U without the umlaut, they pronounce OU. Or in French, they said Pagot. But in fact, the umlaut was a right spell. But for the people, the French people, they dissociate the letter.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes sense, because I've heard it pronounced both ways.
It's not easy, yes, because it's, in fact, it's like a German pronunciation with the umlaut.
So originally the family winery was Ferro Fi, that your grandmother was the winemaker of.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. My grandmother, she came from Isabruzzo in Italy, and she was waitress at the Château de Vaudieu. And she met my grandfather, who was pure French, and he was like farmer for growing vegetables, fruit, not so much involved in the vineyard. And both they worked for Ozo's family in Châteauneuf-du-Pape, and step by step, when the people sometimes they passed away, they gave the right to my grandparents to take care about the vineyard, or they gave to them, or they sold to them because they had a priority, because they worked on the farm. And then my grandmother, she passed away with 22 hectares, which is average 45 acres. But because she had four children, in France we have to share equally. And my father had 5 hectares in heritage.
And your father is Paul?
My father is Paul. It was from teenager. He was really involved in the vineyard because he was the youngest of the family. And the others, they worked at different places. So he was, he liked to be winemaker and vine grower. So he really started and stayed in that work. And my father worked for 5 hectares, but he worked also in a factory because it was not enough to leave long time ago. And I decided to create a company with my father just after my study, enology and viticulture and marketing school. I worked for a company in Paris. Then after a year, I decided to be back to the south of France in Châteauneuf-du-Pape. and asked to my father to create our own company. So my father had to leave his parents and the family business to really create with me something different. So my parents, they had a house, but in fact, we built the winery and the cellar next to my parents' house. Before I arrived, my father made the wine at his parents' house.
Because those are a little far away.
It was not very far. It was from the other side of the village. But I didn't like the way to work, in fact, with my uncle and my aunt. So everybody worked at the same place. It's like a mini chef in one kitchen. That sometimes doesn't work. And I was the youngest to arrive in the family. So mostly of the bad work was from they were from me. So I just decided to move away with my dad, and also to create a name, to not having the same name as the others, like Ferro, is why we call it Pegao. Because I study marketing, I always knew the name has to be short, easy to pronounce. And for me, it was important, a name with a link with the wine or with the pop, Provençal. And the Pegao is the wine pitcher, pichet. And this pichet was used during the 14th century, during the pop period. And I think it was very easy for the people to really remember that short name.
Because the popes were in Avignon for a period of time.
The pope, they arrived in Avignon in the 14th century, and after they built the summer house in Châteauneuf-du-Pape. And if you go on top of the hill where the chateau in Châteauneuf-du-Pape is built, you can see easily Avignon. So they control, in fact, the navigation on the Rhone and for eventually attacked. So the pop, they were very power in this area. And we had three, or I don't remember how many pops, in Châteauneuf-du-Pape. But the summer house was, in fact, built first to be in front of Avignon, but also to plant vines, to produce wine, and to save the mess.
And one of the things that's interesting about your estate is you have parcels all through different parts of Châteauneuf-du-Pape, Montpertuis, Bosquet, Solitude, mm-hmm. Croix. What are those different parcels like? What should I know about them?
This is probably the part I'm very interesting to talk about, is the vineyard. Châteauneuf-du-Pape is on 3,400 hectares, which is 7,000 acres. We are 280 winemakers. We could say all in competition, but no one is in competition with the other one, because there's a lot of characteristic in Châteauneuf-du-Pape to make always a different Châteauneuf-du-Pape. So we have, I could say, four main different terroirs. One of the part of the east of Châteauneuf-du-Pape is in fact La Crau, which is the most famous for the sandy soil, and is a part of Châteauneuf-du-Pape, but depends of another village called Courtaison. Then after, there's a very stony soil, as typical you can see on the photo everywhere, which is Bédaride, the next village, and it's stone, and more we work, more we have stone. Then clay soil, mostly in the middle of Châteauneuf-du-Pape, as you say, Les Bosquets, or north of Châteauneuf-du-Pape, Orange, part of Orange. And there's also very chalk area, which is west of Châteauneuf-du-Pape. And if we grow in Châteauneuf-du-Pape, we have the rights to plant 13 different type of grapes. So the 13 varietal, planted in different soil, gives a different style of wine. But if I want to talk only about Grenache, the Grenache, which is the main varietal in Châteauneuf, the Grenache in the sandy soil, as we have at Pegot, it's very mineral, a great length, with most of the style of Pinot, nice acidity, and good nerve. The Grenache grows into the stone. It's more powerful, rich, as a high alcohol content, because the stone, of course, they keep the heat from the day, and they restitute by night that heat, so the berries are riper. And berries riper, with so they have a high sugar content, and of course the wine will be higher in alcohol. And then Grenache in the stone and clay, it's very typical, has a spicy wine, licorice with a dense middle palate. At Domaine de Pegaud, we don't have Grenache in a cask. We don't have this part of Châteauneuf. But cask also is very mineral and nice spicy, but different as spicy from the clay. So all the different terroirs mixed, in fact, with a different type of grapes. This is very interesting. And then, of course, no one winemaker can make the same wine because they don't pick the grapes in the same time. Sometimes they have a vineyard co-planted, or they have just a field for one type of grapes, and they blend before the process or after the process. Most of them, they destamp now, which is, in fact, they take off the stamp, which we don't do at Domaine de Pegaud. We work the traditional way, full cluster. And after the process, it depends also. At Domaine de Pegaud, we do between 10 to 12 days, because with a full cluster, we don't want any green taste from the stem. Then it's a short process. We just pump over every day or twice a day, very gentle. And then we press after 10, 12 days. For the other winemaker, they could make some longer process for 1 month. And after the aging also, there's no regulation for the aging. We can, at Domaine de Pegaud, we use only large, older cask, 5,000 liters, 6,000 liters. And the barrels, they are between 15 to 90 years old. So they don't give any oaky taste. We age the wine in the old oak to give, in fact, spiciness and to have a wine really better combine.
And then you ferment in concrete.
We ferment in concrete with the 13 type of grapes, because mostly of our vineyard, they are co-planted. But we have 80% Grenache, 6% Syrah, 4% Mourvèdre, and 10% of the different varietal. We cannot really say a percentage. Sometimes it's one or two plant in 2 hectares. But each time we replace, every year, we replace few plant that are dead during the winter or something happened. So we replace by the mixed also varietal. I really want to keep that tradition, because the name of my top cuvée, Dacapo, became, in fact, from the idea to continue to respect the tradition with the 13 type of grapes.
And you use the press wine.
Yes, there's a free range juice and the press, yes. Because the selection in Châteauneuf-du-Pape, the regulation is one of the strict regulation in France. But the regulation is more based in the vineyard, like regulation for pruning, 5 pieces of wood with 2 buds, maximum 10 branches, maximum 3,500 liters per 2.5 acres. There's also regulation about the alcohol, which is a minimum 13.5. So there's a regulation mostly in the vineyard we have to respect to produce concentrate wine and a typical Châteauneuf-du-Pape.
But in terms of using the press wine, how does that play in?
In fact, yes. Also, the regulation is, in fact, we pick the grapes by hand. We are not allowed for a machine. So we pick by hand. And each picker, they have a bucket, and they bring the bucket to the tractor, where in fact we spread the bucket on the top, and we can see and make a selection of the bunch. So we declassified between 5% to 20% of the bunch. They are not good enough to go into the Châteauneuf-du-Pape. But this selection is very subjective. Depends the winemaker if they really want a concentrate wine, so they will be stricter about the selection. The others, they will judge probably a few bunches that are good enough to go into the Châteauneuf-du-Pape. But we have to do minimum 5% of the selection. So this is, in fact, it's a pre-selection. So we don't need after to select the juice. So it's why the fragrances and the juice from the press, they are blend.
When you make the difference between the Cuvée Reserve and the Cuvée Laurence, it's actually a matter of élevage in terms of length of time and wood. It's not different parcels.
No, it's not different parcels. The Cuvée Laurence, in fact, became from the beginning because during the late 80s and early 90s, my father sold mostly of the wine in bulk. And when we started to have Domaine de Pégot in 1987, we didn't sell enough the wine bottled. So we had to sell mostly in bulk to get the money and to pay back the building we have done, the winery and everything. So what we did, we couldn't, in fact, bottling 5,000 bars in once. So all the time we bottled 2,000 and again 2,000. So depending, in fact, the vintage or how fast the first bottling was sold. And then we redone again a new bottling. So that means for the Cuvée Réservé, we had three different bottling. And then for the Cuvée Laurence, it was even latest bottling. But the thing is, I had probably one of the oldest clients. It was a wine importer in U.S. in Michigan. He imported some of Ferro and Fils before we created Domaine de Pégot. And that man, I remember, always asked for the latest bottling because he likes really the spiciness of Châteauneuf-du-Pape when it aged long time in the barrel. And it was impossible each time said, okay, this is the first or second bottling for you. This is the latest bottling for you. So in fact, I decided very quickly to do everything latest bottling in Cuvée Laurence, even if we had two or three bottling Cuvée Laurence and two or three Cuvée Réservé bottling. But we needed really to have at one point a difference between I could say 3 years aging and before 4 years, 5 years aging in the barrels. But everything became more organized during the, I could say, 96, 98, especially 98, with the new top cuvée of Da Capo. We had really to say, okay, mostly of our production is on the Cuvée Réservé. And today we produce 75,000 bottles of a Cuvée Réservé. Cuvée Réservé is Domaine de Pégot. It's exactly what I want to place, to settle, to export everywhere in the world. And the Cuvée Laurence now is really one barrel, the same blend, the same wine as the Réservé. And we age an extra 2 years. So total 4 years for the Cuvée Laurence. But this is, in fact, organized step by step during, in fact, our life and our experience.
What was the thought process into making the Capo Cuvée, which was, as you said, the first release in 98?
The Cuvée da Capo is a big story. The Cuvée da Capo, the first Cuvée da Capo was in 1998. But I remember in 1997, 1995, I was in Amsterdam. I travel and try to sell the wine better and better. And I met different winemakers as Rich, or Turley, or many of Joseph Fares, and also some of those winemakers, even Champagne, or winemaker for me, it was sometimes Burgundy, which I love Burgundy wine. And it was very difficult for me to access to some very expensive wine because the Chateau M. Dupin was not expensive. And I couldn't believe, you know, being a winemaker, and I couldn't drink what I like or what I wanted to try and experiment. And in the meantime, there were many people in Châteauneuf-du-Pape. They exported to US. I also exported to US. And in USA, when you open a wine list in a restaurant, you all the time you read Zinfandel. At that time, it was very famous. Zinfandel, Cabernet, or Syrah. But in fact, it was not the appellation. And many of people from Châteauneuf-du-Pape, they wanted to do a Châteauneuf-du-Pape with one type of grapes. And because I always supported the traditional way to make the Châteauneuf-du-Pape, I said, no, I don't want to make a wine for a country or for people. I'm completely against. What I want is to educate people and to explain them why we have appellation. And they have to understand. You know, for wines like Burgundy, it's only Pinot. It's simple. Bordeaux, okay, there's Merlot and Cabernet. But for Bordeaux, it was easier to export because it was Cabernet. But for us, to explain Grenache and all the 12 others, the blend before in USA was in fact the wine not with a high value because the palate was not educated and they didn't understand the way we work for the appellation. And when I started to do the Dacapo in Châteauneuf-du-Pape, we say it's a symphony of the 13 type of grapes. And I wanted to be back on that symphony, is why I call it Dacapo, as in music, Dacapo. And we always say the Grenache is a piano, the Syrah violin, and each type of grapes has its own instrument. You can read that somewhere. It's explained in Châteauneuf-du-Pape. And I call it, I wanted to call it opera, but I think it was too simple. But da capo was more, I think, a strong word. And it's why we started with that wine. And the 1998 was on the market with the name So da capo for 4,000 bottles. And the price was 100 euro. That was average 500 francs.
Because I've seen it for, you know, over $1,000 in the States, at restaurants at least.
I don't remember the franc, actually. I completely forgot the franc. So it was, 500 francs. But everybody really was shocked by, in fact, that price. But not abroad, because I knew it was accessible for the others, and I wanted to in fact earn money to buy some more wine from abroad. I wanted to buy Burgundy, I wanted to buy Californian wine, I wanted to buy wine from everywhere, first to be more educated, and second because I judge the wine, my wine had the same value as the others. But it was a real push in Châteauneuf-du-Pape, I think. Even if now the price, they are higher, but maybe the others, they still not probably 100% agree with me. But I think I push the price in Châteauneuf-du-Pape, and I'm quite proud about it.
Sometimes I've seen really quite big bottles of Capo. Did you bottle a few large format?
Yes, we do. We like 15 liters. We only do five large format. Five. We have 12, 9, 6, 3, Magnum, and bottle.
And what was the significance of 98? I mean, obviously, appraised vintage, a lot of heat that year. But why did you pick that year to begin with the Capo?
because for me, it's like a coup de cœur for many things in a life. I just I like one barrel, and I always went on the top of the barrels and tasted wine. And I said, no, I don't want to blend that wine with a cuvée réservée. If I really didn't insist, my father would blended the wine with these barrels with a cuvée réservée, but I wanted to keep it apart, and I did it.
So I've had the Capo 2003 a few times, and I've had the Reserve 2003, and they're pretty different, I think, in terms of taste.
Yeah, different vintage, but the same way to do it.
But how would you describe the differences in where the Capo is sourced and what it tastes like?
I don't decide about the wine. I'm picking grapes. It's more than 26 years I'm picking grapes every day. This is like a part of my holiday. I love going in a vineyard and picking grapes from 7 in the morning with the pickers. And I can eat the grapes. And if the weather has been good from spring to the harvest, and I can feel the crispy skin or the quality of the berries come up and up during the harvest, I said, oh, this is a good vintage to do a da Capo. But that doesn't mean I'm not looking for a style. I'm looking for a good wine and a balance, but specifically balanced.
The vines are pretty old, though, like yes. 1902.
Lacroix is more than 100 years old. It's a wine with sandy soil, so very elegant, and it's 70% of the da Capo. So da Capo, people never tasted the da Capo. They could say, oh, the da Capo is a very strong and power wine. It's not, because 70% mixed type of grapes from sandy soil, it's very elegant. Of course, on top of that, it's better to put 20% of stony soil, which is in fact give the style of Châteauneuf-du-Pape with the power and the fatness and roundness. So this is important. And 10% of the red clay, which is the middle palate, will be something a little bit sticky on the tang with the people. They will really enjoy it. And for the da Capo, I think the consumer, each consumer, he will find something he will like in the da Capo. It's why I'm looking for the balance, but not for a balance of one wine. I like the balance for different style. Is why probably I pick up the vintage, not thinking about the style of the wine, but more about what the vintage will give.
What's it like to grow Grenache versus growing Syrah? Do you handle them differently in the vineyard?
For sure, because there's a regulation about that. There's only one type of grapes in Châteauneuf-du-Pape we can put on the trailers, which is Syrah. The Grenache is pruned as gobelet, short pruning. I call it bonsai pruning. It's a short pruning. So we have 12 different types of grapes, including the white short pruning and only Syrah on the trailers. Now, many years ago, some vine growers, they asked to put the white varieties on the trailers, because the Roussan had a very long branches as the Syrah. So they slightly changed the regulation for the white. You know, in Châteauneuf-du-Pape, we produce some red wine. As Bigot, we produce red wine with red bunches, but also white bunches. We have a part of the little vineyard is white and pruned in gobelet pruning, short pruning, and we blend the bunches, the white bunches, with the red bunches. And we can make the process. We have to make the process, the red and the white together. We can mix together before the process, never after, but before the process. But by this slightly change of the regulation, they said if the vinegarer put the white varieties on the trailers, so he can put on the trailers Roussanne, Clairette, Grenache White, and Bourboulec, with only one condition, he has to produce only white wine. But he cannot blend anymore the white with the red. So at Domaine de Pego, we have 1.5 hectares in white. So we have 70 acres, 0.7, pruned in goblet. Then we can blend with our red. And we have 0.7 on the trailers, and we only produce some white wine from Châteauneuf-du-Pape.
So what's claret like to grow? Because I don't think outside of Châteauneuf-du-Pape, it's not a well-known grape variety, at least for Americans.
Claret has the higher acidity, latest ripe, good citrus. I could say it's very important to have claret to have a Châteauneuf-du-Pape white, quite lively, with a nice acidity. Without claret, I'm afraid sometimes the white is too heavy, too alcoholic. With the claret, that brings, in fact, some earth and livelier white wine. It's not easy to make some white wine in a very hot area as Châteauneuf-du-Pape.
And is there a significant difference between Grenache Blanc and Grenache Rouge outside of pigmentation? I mean, is it essentially the same thing, or is it very different?
Taste is different. Grenache White, the berries, they have the same shape, red or white. But the white, you can eat some white Grenache berries. For the red, it's more difficult. You can feel the Grenache red is really for the vat. But I can eat some Grenache white as some grapes for the table, as a fruit. But it's better to taste Bourboulec, which I like when I eat like that. But mostly of that variétal, they are for the vat, to produce wine. And Châteauneuf-du-Pape also has Picpoul. We don't have Picpoul. We have Picpoul blend in a red field, but we don't have a vineyard Picpoul. But now some of the vine growers, they realized Picpoul. It was a very simple type of grapes produced in the south of France, much more in the Languedoc. But Picpoul has a lot of freshness and the minerality. So Picpoul is very interesting.
Kind of a green apple taste, kind of like malic acidity, I think.
Yes. And the white and the red, for me, I really want to keep some white in the red, because people before, they co-planted white, red, and all the different type of grapes in Châteauneuf in the same field. And there's 2 points. First, in the wine, I think the white bring the acidity and also the freshness, which is very important in the red, when the red is quite power. So we don't, in Châteauneuf-du-Pape, we can add some acid tartric, but we don't need to add too much acid tartric when we have that blend. And the wine, we can feel the wine, I can say, more digest. The alcohol is a little bit lower when we also blend with some white varieties, which is quite important about that. And also, I talk with people, they study about the different time of the maturity. And we don't have the result actually about some experiment, which I'm interesting to know in the future, because I'm a small domain. I cannot do so much experiment, but I'm always talking and I'm always having some idea with the others. It's in fact, why the maturity is more consistent on one field with a mixed type of grapes. Like a Grenache planted next to a Mourvèdre, which in fact, Grenache and Mourvèdre, Mourvèdre is the latest ripe. Then another, most of the time when we pick different type of grapes on the same row, the maturity has not a very large difference. And when we plant one field of Grenache, one field of Mourvèdre, then the maturity is very different. There's a different time for picking. So what we need to study, is there any probably point about when the bees comes and the flower comes in the same time? Is it a really micro, you know, activity or microclimate or micro? There's something happen because it's more, in fact, homogeneous when it's co-planted. So this is a point maybe to clear up in the future by people and the research.
It seems like most of your vineyard parcels are co-planted. Is that true?
Yeah. Mm.
And with the red wines, I often find that they age quite well and sort of demand some age as well. What would I expect with the white wine, which I have less experience with? Is that a wine for drinking somewhat early, or is it something I should lay down?
So the white, it depends about the white and the varieties. For Pigot, we have a 60% Claret. So it's white wine, very nice freshness. 20% Grenache, white, to have a minimum of 13.5% alcohol.
Because the Grenache has a little bit more sugar extract.
Yes. And we have 10% Bourboulec and 10% Roussanne. The Bourboulec, the berries are a little bit bigger. And the Bourboulec has a nice flavor as the Roussanne. But the Roussanne, the name Roux means red. But the Roussanne is a white variety with a red point. In fact, this type of grapes will give us some color, more gold color. So the way we make the wine at Domaine de Pigot, I mean, we press directly the four type of grapes together. We cool down the juice really low temperature. Then the heavy deposit will just drop down, and then we will rack, and then step by step we'll raise the temperature until 16. We'll add some yeast, and it will be a very cool temperature process for 2 or 3 weeks. Then the wine will become with all the freshness and the style of each varieties. When the wine is produced in September, it's usually bottled in January, February, the year after. And it's good to drink the wine the year following the bottling or to keep it over 3 years. The years between, the first years to the fourth years, this is not a good time to drink the Chateauneuf du Pape white.
So in a way, it's sort of forbidden by law to make a really crisp, lean Chateauneuf du Pape of white, of low alcohol, because there's a minimum alcohol level.
There's a minimum, yeah.
So even if you wanted to make something that tasted like Sancerre, you wouldn't be allowed to call it Chateauneuf du Pape. You'd have to declassify it.
Nobody really liked to declassify Chateauneuf du Pape because to declassify with low alcohol, we cannot have, the name Chateauneuf du Pape on the label. We can even not use the typical bottles printed with a key.
Sure, with the keys.
And a hat pop. So the tiers, so it's difficult to, and also we have taxes on the vineyards.
That stay the same no matter what you bottle from it.
Because it's included in the appellation. So I don't see probably the point to really declassify it.
But But you do make some Vindatab and Vindapai reds, Plant Pigo, which is a wine I like a lot.
Plant Pigo or Pink Pigo now?
Yeah, I haven't had the pink one. What's it like to make a rosé?
Yeah, this is from Chateau Pigo. Yes, Pink Pigo.
Oh, in so fact, it's from a different parcel. It's from the Côte d'Aron parcel.
Yes.
Okay.
But in fact, we have Châteauneuf du Pape. We always had Châteauneuf du Pape and Plant Pigo. Plant Pigo is a table wine, and now we call it Vin de France. At Pigo, the Vin de France has never been vintaged, so that means it's three vintages blend. A part of the vintage age in a small barrique, but old barrique, and the other part in the vat. We blend and we do the style of the Plant Pigo. We had only two wines. The Plant Pigo was considered as the little wine of Pigo. But in fact, it's outside of any appellation, outside of Côte d'Huron, outside of Côte d'Huron village. We can plant any type of grapes we want and we can produce any quantity we want. Because we always wanted to bottle the Plant Pigo, so of course we always maintain a certain level of quality. Now with Côte d'Huron, the new vineyard, because we bought a new property of 60 hectares, 120 acres, included 84 acres of Côte d'Huron, Côte d'Huron village, and again, Vin de France. In that Vin de France, we produce some red wine, and we can blend with the Plant Pigo we had before, and we produce also rosé. When we produce a Vin de France, we are not allowed to call it Côte d'Huron, or we are not allowed to call it Château. So the name has to be stronger, I mean, more marketing and to sell than really the name of the appellation. There's no appellation. So Plant Pigo, everybody call it Plant Pigo. Nobody call it Côte d'Huron because it's not. And nobody call it Vin de France. So now we have two wines, more and more famous by the name, Pink Pigo and Plant Pigo. But we produce from the bench, from outside of any appellation.
And that 60-hectare purchase happened in 2011?
12.
Oh, in 12, okay.
The 12 red, 2012 is our first vintage.
And so what's it been like working in different zones? Because you also do some of the ghost work in places like Ségouret and things. How are the surrounding zones a little different than Châteauneuf?
It's difficult. From Domaine de Pigo always was Domaine de Pigo, and I always really keep it apart. In 2001, many of my wine importers, they asked me to find for them a new producer or a new wine because they couldn't travel or they were quite interested with my taste or what I blended. So I decided to create my company and to say, okay, I'm not a négociant because I don't buy any wine. I have no storage, but I'm going to see different winemakers. I blend, and after they bottled under my label.
Selection Lawrence Furrow.
Oh, yes. So it's not a wine I buy and after I blend with someone else. It's mostly of the time is, in fact, only one wine producer I selected. And inside is winery or cellar. We can do some blend to export.
And then there's also the Furrow Brunel
negotiation. Ferro Brunel, that was just before. In fact, Ferro Brunel was in 1999, we created the company. That was the same. In fact, Ferro Brunel, we are six in Ferro Brunel. So we didn't look really to make some money. We were, in fact, six people to share the work and to have our own section for working. Ferro Brunel was in fact the start of a wine selection, and especially made by Philippe Cambi, who is a famous enologist. So Philippe Cambi is also a part of the company, André Brunel and I, and the other partner. But André Brunel and I, we had many importers, and we wanted to supply them with Gigondas or with other wine. The thing is, sometimes Ferro Bruno is really good as a really power wine, powerful, with the style of Brunel and I, is a real blend of our style, what we like and what Philippe also, the oenologist, like. The Selection Laurence Ferro is different, is more elegant and spicy. But we have two different markets for that. And it's still working very well, both. So there's no competition between the two different names.
What degree of the Domaine Pagot or Pagot wines are exported? How much is exported?
95%.
That seems rather high for a French producer.
Yes, yes. 95% to 40 countries, 80 wine importers. In U.S., I have 3 wine importers in U.S.
Because you've had a long relationship with Dan Kravitz at Handpicked Selections.
Yes, but before, as I talk about the Michigan, before Pagot was created, J.C. Mathes, he was a professor of the University of Michigan, and his hobby was to import some wine for France. And in fact, he turned his hobby in a company. And the company didn't increase a lot because it was not his own job, and it was not specifically for a large business. He's just wanted to import the wine from the wine producer he really loved the best, because J.C. Mathes, mostly of the summer, he spent the summer in the south of France. So I could say 30 years ago, much before Pagot, 30 years ago, that man really mostly lived in the south of France. So he knew all the tiny road, all the little winemaker, with a completely different philosophy as now. So his business became famous 15 years ago, I could say, by, you know, this business explosion about the, you know, expand suddenly about the wine. But Dan Kravitz, I met Dan in 1987. Just when I started to create Pagot, and Dan Kravitz was really for business, and the business really increased, and now it's a big company. Then also I had Martin Swine, which in fact the company has recently sold, and Greg Castell. Now we with some partners took the company back to Martin. So with Martin's, but I never gave any, I could say, exclusivity. But I always wanted the three importers, they respect the states where they worked. And so Martin had, and Greg now, same, Martin's wine is in California and Nevada for Pagot. Ferro Bruno for mostly of the states. And DNS, Do Not Spit, has Texas for Ferro Bruno. Then for Domaine de Pagot, Jenna has been transformed in J&J in the Michigan and Texas. And Handpicked Selection has all the other states. Because and Handpicked has Chateau Pagot plus Selection Laurence Ferro.
Oh, okay, okay.
So Dan has mostly other things.
Because Dan Kravitz always seemed to have a strong relationship with Robert Parker, or at least Parker praised him in print several times.
I don't know about Dan Kravitz and his relation with Robert Parker. I have no idea about that. I never seen really Dan Kravitz talking about Robert Parker. No, they just... maybe just send the sample, as many importers, they need sometimes some help, because it's true, it's quite helpful if the winemaker is well rated. It's easier to sell the wine. And not only the wine rated, it's easier to sell all the wine. because that help. If, for example, Domaine de Pigot has 96 points on a wine, it's easy to sell Domaine de Pigot, but most of the time they add some other wines because it's like they tracked everything.
Because, I mean, in your situation, you've had some very high scores from not just Parker, but from the Wine Spectator, but at least, 600-point ratings in about 10 years, something like that? Mm-hmm. So what's that been like for you? Because that's, you know, somewhat unusual.
I don't know.
When did that start? 90?
Yes, in 1990. That really helped in 1990 to sell. In 1990, we started to sell the stock my father had before Pigot. We sold in 1992 all the vintage 1990, and that really helped to pay back the investment we have done. Since we expanded the vineyard, so today in total we have 71 hectares of vineyard, 71. So that really helped to, of course, to become famous. But we didn't, when I say I don't know, that means I didn't really think about having a wine rated. I always produce the wine I like, the wine I will be able to drink. And without really try to copy someone else, just to have my own signature. My father gave me the experience, and I got after from school what I knew. And at the beginning, it has never been very easy. So, of course, when each time the wine has been rated was for us like a nice breath to get further, to go in the front. That was very important. It was, for me, I never been proud because I make wine and this is my job. So if you like your job, you try to do it well. You are not looking always to be awarded. If you are satisfied, I mean, about the sales and the pleasure you have, then after everything, I mean, when the wine, they were well rated, of course, we sold the wine easier. And the money was for, not for living more comfortable, but to buy more vineyard because we are farmer. And French winemakers, they are not like American. We are an old country. So we really live about the history, about, you know, what we will give to our children. So for us, we always think about generation and generation. It's not only one product. It's what we do and we make for many generations. And we want, in fact, the last generation be proud of the new generation. And we pass some, history about that. And it's very different than the American, in fact, style. I mean, sometimes the people, they are winemakers, they plant vines, then they pull out vines, they do another, they plant something else. In France, no. And also because Châteauneuf-du-Pape, it's an area quite famous, we cannot do anything we want. We have to prove it's a terroir, it's a wine, always been famous in the world, and we have to continue in that way.
How old's your dad today?
75.
Is he still working in the vines?
I try to push him to work. First, because it's important for him. No, he doesn't work in a vineyard. I mean, not full time, no. But he is getting up early. He speaks with the three employees I have. And even the Pigot company, we have a very good relation with the people they work for us. It's like a large family, and I prefer to work that way as a big company. It's why probably the people, they ask me, when I pick the grapes, most of the time, the people next to me, they said, oh, you know what, the vineyard, are you working here for a long time? And I said, yes, but I couldn't guess I'm the boss because I'm picking grapes all the time. After, it depends about your education, you couldn't change. If someone, you know, there's some businessmen, they work all their life, they will never stop working. My father is the same, and I think I will be the same.
But early on in your relationship, he focused more on the vines and you were doing more cellar work. Is that true or no?
Oh, yes. He always ran the vines. But my father was still a good vine grower. We never changed the way of working vines as well. For him, he grew up in as being vine grower. But we are not organic certified, but we always work as a natural respect. We always have this pheromone in a vineyard. We always work the soil. We never put in
for the insects, cures. Like for yes. the sexual confusion, that
yes.
stuff?
Yes, yes. So in fact, we always work the same way, but my father was a good vine grower, a good winemaker as well, without a wine analysis or whatever. Then after, as I said, he has the experience and I knew more about the analysis about the wine and the way I knew more the way how to conduct really to drive. The domain in the business and my point of view about also because I always travel and I love traveling and because I love the contact with the people and different population and what they like, what they eat, what they drink, what is their taste, which in fact is different in any countries. So this is very interesting about the human connection. And I always report what I met at the domain and try to explain to my dad. And together we try to just understand and to go in the way we needed to go.
It seems like there have been vintages that were quite warm and vintages that were cooler. What's it like in terms of the growing side and then the production side to make wines from those kinds of different vintages in Châteauneuf-du-Pape?
It's many, many years now. I decide exactly the day we start for picking grapes. Because in the village, there's a part of people, like also my dad, they said, oh, we have to start on the 15th of September. But that means nothing, depending the vintage, depending the weather. So as many years, I don't know when exactly I started, but I said, no. We need to go in the vineyard. First, we need to see the probably percentage of alcohol. We don't talk in bricks. We talk in probably percentage alcohol with a refractometer. So we can just have an idea about what the alcohol would be. And after, for me, I really taste the berries, each berries. I pick the berries on the grapes if it comes easily. That means it's ripe. If we had a lot of rain during the spring or the summer, the berries are bigger, the skin are thinner. And it is less crispy, so it will be less color concentrate. If the berries are smaller, of course, it's less juice, but darker color, more tannin. If the peeps, they come easily out from the pulps. But all that, it's every vintage difference. But for me, I taste a lot. My father is better to taste after the process. I cannot taste must. I mean, my father takes the berries from the must when it has been fermented, which for me, I have no idea about that. But I have the idea on the fruit. Then I decided to pick up earlier or later, depending the vintage. And the result is much more homogene when we picked at the right time. This is very important. When the fruit is cut from the plant, there's nothing to do. It's finished. Then after, it's always as a gamble. We can leave the bunch longer. We could have a bad weather. Now with the forecast previous weekend, we know a week in advance is not 100%, but it is good. Then we can plan. We can plan. So this is important about the vintage. But the most difficult vintage in my life, which I really needed my father, but it was good to be two. It was 2003. It was a vintage like unbelievable. So it was very funny because even my father was worried about finishing all the sugar contained in the wine because... in fact, all the berries, they were so ripe and overripe. The alcohol was over than 16% alcohol. And we needed to finish the 3-4 grams of sugar left, which it was not easy. And that took quite a long time. The process, they were not finished in December. Few that they were finished before December, then after in spring, the year after, it was very, very difficult. And for my father, he said, no, we have to really fill up the vat, closed, no air, nothing, no oxygen, and forget it, leave it quiet. And the nature will do what it is. But every day we were worried. I said, are you sure is the right thing to do? He said, yes. And the day after, he asked me, are you sure I'm doing well? Or do you think we can do something else? So both, we were not sure. So this is, but it's good to be two. And two, I can say two with a strong temper. Because he believe about what I said or I believe about what he said. Sometimes we can argue. Of course, and we argue quite a lot, but it's because with a strong temper, it's not only one who decide. We always switch or decide, and we always go in the front. So this is a big difference between probably the people, they are on their own to take a decision. You really have to be strong. For us, we don't have any analogist. So we work, just him and I.
And no Pigao in 2002, the year before.
I did a Pigao in 2002, but I didn't put Cuvée Réservée on the next label. And recently I organized a vertical tasting, but 2002 missed. I had no one bottle left and no 1991.
That was a somewhat difficult year for you to sell, right? Didn't that stick around the cellar for a bit?
1987, I sold it in England to a Nethergate, who was a very old wine importer. 2002, Dan Kravitz took quite a lot. And 1991, I don't remember. Maybe we sold a part in bulk. That could happen as well. But 2002... it was not a big deal to sell 2002 because we produced 50% less and the price was 50% less. So in fact, that was yes. But to have a good vintage, we need to have a bad vintage. Oh, after it's really boring to have only good vintage, and the people they don't know what to buy. So it's better the up and down. And on the marketing for me, on the market, like 2008, I decreased the price. 2009, I increased. 2010, even more. 2011, I decreased. And etc. I know what it will be also for the next vintage. And it's very interesting because there's a distribution for expensive vintage, top vintage for probably collectioner, private customers, and really, I could say, really knowledge consumers. And for the vintage, they have good quality. And the price is much lower. It's very accessible for the restaurant. And for the market, I'm very happy because many restaurants, they get into their wine list Pegal, thanks to the vintage, easy approachable by the quality and the price. So in fact, I gain more client in a way.
I was sort of taken aback recently by the consistency across the vintages and the way that I felt like 2009 was very similar to 98, maybe a half degree more alcohol. But stylistically, it seems almost the same, just younger. How did you feel about it, and how was the difference between 9 and 10?
9 for me is very rustic, traditional. In U.S., there's always the... When they are on a chatting on the internet about the Brett, the 2009 as sometimes is a little bit like stable. And they are very sensitive to the stable smell.
Like a horse stable.
Yeah.
Not stable, like it's
no, calm. Horse stable, yeah.
But that was a characteristic of the 98, too. There was like a leathery bread stuff.
Yes, this is Châteauneuf-du-Pape style. But after this, people, they like or they don't like. So 2009 for me was not too far than 1999 as well. Similar smell, which some people, they love it. Like, they are crazy about that. And the users, they hate. So it's very divided in two styles of the consumer. 2010, it's pure, concentrate, clean. 2010, of course, suits mostly of the consumer. And that is more licorice, nice concentrate fruit. It's a great vintage. I like both. Depending on the food.
What's next for Pegal? What's going to happen in the future?
I have no idea yet. 2012, it's fantastic. It's as good as 2010. But no Dacapo. I think I just need a break for the Dacapo. So 2010 was fantastic for the Dacapo. I need a break for 2012. Not everyone did a great vintage in 2012. So I think Pego 12 has a réservé and the potential to do a Dacapo. I think the réservé will be fantastic with the same price as 2010. So I'm very happy with that. 2013 will be a little more difficult as it was a cooler vintage. But cooler vintage like 2008, but with more fruit, a little more concentration for 2013. But it will be very interesting because the very high natural acidity will give a very fresh 2013. But that the consumer, they will understand later. 13 will be a great vintage for aging. Not something rich and power and not jammy, but something straight, a little bit sharp, but very very elegant. It will be good. But of course, the price will be lower than 2012 because there's no choice. When on the market is not a top vintage, I don't want to spend... I travel enough to sell the wine, and especially the Côte du Rhône, now to start on the market. I don't want to really, keep the same price as 2012 and really take 3-4 years to sell 2013. I want the vintage, they turn over every 2 years quite fast, and there's always a new vintage coming in the market. The people that are curious or they want to be educated, they will pick up a 2013, they will pick up a 2012. This is an evidence of the nature to have different vintages. And this is all the interest about the wine. For me, it's clear.
Laurence Ferreau of Pegal, she's bringing forth the evidence of nature. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you to you. And I'm very happy to be in US.
Laurence Farreau of Domaine de Pigalle and Chateau Pigalle. Oh, yes, it's Levy, and I've got some exciting, exciting news for you. 750 is now available in several more states. That's right, the amazingly powerful and easy-to-use 750 service and search tools are now available for wholesale buyers to use in Illinois, Massachusetts, Washington, D.C., Virginia, Maryland, North Carolina, and South Carolina. That's in addition to all the states it's already been successful in, New York, New Jersey, California, Colorado, Connecticut, and Delaware. The 750 service is an amazingly powerful, simple-to-use, fundamental part of making your life as a wholesale buyer easier every day. Check it out, 750.com, for more information. That's 750.com. If you're a wholesale buyer in Boston, Chicago, D.C., anywhere in Virginia, check it out. 750 is there for you, ready to use. It's exciting. Get on it. The big news for the podcast in 2014, retail partnership, my friend. The wines we care about from the folks who are on the show, offered to you by the excellent team at Vine Wine. Go to vine-wine.com for more information about what we're up to and to find the wines. That's vine-wine.com. Check it out. Cheers.
And that's our show today. Thanks for listening. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and our own dedicated website, alldrinktothatpod.com. No apostrophe.